This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Go to Squarespace.com and use offer code Duncan to receive 10% off your brand new badass website. Give them a shot. Here we go.
Oh, hell no. Put your grandmother back in her coffin and welcome into your ear holes America's number one podcaster. Broadcasting from the sub-basement of the Monsanto building, where he lives inside a chilled, vibrating, gelatinous cube of genetically modified broccoli. He loves you and wants to lead you to the skin of the earth serpent so that you can suckle at its white nectar and dance beneath the eyeball we call the sun. Open your heart, mind, soul, and chakras to the king of blab. One ball, man, boobs, and ready to yap. It's your friend and mine, the Philip the Pinehead.
Shouldn't have done it, but I downloaded 17 gigs of Japanese foot fetish porn and installed one of these new sarcasm viruses into my computer that mocks everything you do. I've been basically struggling for the last couple of days to do this intro without the virus stepping in and making fun of me and my podcast and doing that sarcastic baby voice. But I think I just mastered it. So I think we're all right. Good news, I have found a new place. The Lord of Podcasts has delivered me from the baking, smoldering interior of this hellhouse to a place that has, as far as I'm concerned, the ultimate thing that you can have in the rapidly disintegrating, incinerating city of Los Angeles, which is Central Air. Central Air is the finger of Christ touching your heart. Central Air is the sweat dripping off the brow of Buddha as he gained enlightenment. Central Air is the urine of Shiva pouring down upon your burning body in the fires of hell. Central Air in a house where I will be able to do a podcast without baking and having to do what I did last night, which is send the entire audio file to a wonderful, wonderful person who out of the blue emailed me and told me that if I sent him an audio file, he would fix it because he's an audio engineer. Now, I don't think that he realized when he asked me to do that, that I would actually take him up on the offer, because I recorded this podcast with Mikey Campman, and I don't want to place a hierarchy on podcasts, but as far as I'm concerned, this is one of my favorite podcasts of all time, because he told me one of the creepiest, spookiest, weirdest stories about what it was like being up in Antarctica as a breakfast cook. And I'm not going to spoil it for you. I'm just going to let you listen to it. But I didn't want you guys to get a shitty version of that sound file with my very loud, clanky, portable air conditioner running in the background. So I sent this file over, and this human being did the most magical work that I've ever seen on this sound file, because the sound file before I sent it to him sounded like somebody had placed a microphone inside a experimental monkey cage where the monkeys had been injected with some kind of high-powered, deadly adrenal plague venom that was making them go into an orgy of death. So thank you, Rob Crew. You are truly an sonic necromancer. Anybody, if you need any kind of audio work done. I highly recommend Rob Crew. You can go to his website, www.stillwaterstudios.ca, or you can check out his resume at www.robcrewe.com. Links will be at duncantrussell.com. Send him a nice message of love, won't you? Because just out of the blue, he put a shit ton of work into this thing.
Sorry, guys. It keeps coming back in. We've got a great painting.
Wonderful tales of adventure from the great...
Great painting.
We're going to dive right into it. But first... Today's episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the sweet web godlings over at Squarespace.com. Use offer code Duncan and you'll get 10% off your order. Because our poor human mind is incapable of understanding the exponential greatness of the impending singularity, we still try to function according to an old capitalist paradigm, which involves building a brick and mortar store and standing there for an hours at a time selling whatever it is that you want to sell to whoever happens to walk by. This is an antiquated, outdated shit system. You no longer have to put your flesh and blood at risk of being massacred by some gun-wielding lunatic. You don't have to worry about the wrong baby sneezing on you and coming home and shitting out your intestines because you have Ebola anymore. You can start a massive, profitable, amazing online business just by going to Squarespace.com. They have a beautiful design. It's simple and powerful. They have 24/7 support via live chat and email. I tried it to make sure it definitely works. It's only $8 a month, and you get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for a year. Every website comes with a free online store, so it's got everything that you need. You no longer have to hire some unscrupulous web designer who will no doubt take whatever momentum you had moving in the direction of fulfilling your dreams of actually being your own boss and transform it into a trickle of diarrhea and failure. You could go to Squarespace and immediately start some kind of badass business, blog, podcast, whatever it is today. I think everyone on planet Earth should have a podcast. I don't think there's any limit to podcasting. I think it's a brand new medium of expression that uses a technological canvas that is very inexpensive to obtain. And the number one reward you're going to get out of a podcast is the experience of what it's like to have a nice conversation with a human being in a kind of formal environment. It's a beautiful, fun thing to do. And if you want to have a podcast, you got to have a website. And Squarespace is a great way for you to dip your toes into the water of podcasting or whatever it may be that you want to play around with. Remember, this technology is brand new on planet Earth. It's never been here before, and you can grab a hold of it and use it for only $8 a month. That's pretty badass. You can start a trial. You don't even need a credit card. That means you can go to Squarespace and just try it out. If it doesn't work for you, fine. What's the big deal? You lose nothing. So give them a shot. These are our longest sponsors, and I hope you'll at least try it out if you've been thinking about doing something online. Remember, use offer code Duncan. You'll get 10% off your first purchase and show your support for Squarespace. And thanks, you guys, for supporting this podcast. We're also brought to you by Amazon.com. I invite you to use our portal located at DuncanTrussell.com. The next time you want to buy something from Amazon, they literally have everything. Currently, I'm sorry that every time I do an episode, I list some product that I love, but certain products are amazing. Certain things will actually change your life. I'm sorry to say, I'd like it that we were all just photosynthetic and the only thing we needed is to lay outside in the nude and let the dripping nectar of flowers fall upon us as we absorb the sunlight and feed hummingbirds via our nipples. But that's not the way it works, hippie! Sometimes buying stuff actually does make you happier. It just does. It's the truth. And I'll tell you, if you want to do a big life change in the direction of pure hedonism, get a Breville espresso machine. get one of these. My wonderful girlfriend just bought one of these for me, and my Christ, I was a little skeptical about having an espresso machine at my house, but until you've tasted that first sweet caramel trickle of the delicious espresso you produced in the comfort of your own home, you don't know what it is to be an American. Try it out yourself, or try any of the other awesome stuff there. Toilet paper, whatever it is you need, wipes, you can get it all at Amazon. You don't have to go to a store anymore. It's true. We are in the future, friends. And if you're going to go to Amazon, just make sure you go through our portal located at duncantrussell.com. We got a lot of t-shirts, posters. We've got these brand new tapestries, which are located in the shop section of duncantrussell.com. We've got stickers. It's all there for you. And a giant thank you to those of you who continue to donate to this podcast. You don't have to do it, but I'm very grateful when you do. But all you got to do is enjoy the show, keep listening to it, tell your friends, and correct me whenever I make massive errors in whatever particular scientific or spiritual theory I'm espousing that I just read off the internet or found on some kind of Shakespeare meme. I appreciate you guys so much. You're the best fans out there, and I'm so grateful that you listen. Really quickly, I want to give a shout out to my friend who emailed me from somewhere on the Appalachian Trail. He said he was actually inspired by this podcast. I showed it to my girlfriend because I felt so weirdly proud and excited to think that this thing had actually gotten somebody out on the Appalachian Trail. Her response to me was that my listeners are a million times more adventurous than I am, and I couldn't agree with her more. Somehow, through this podcast, I have summoned up a guru that is all of you guys, and I love you so much. So, Bradley, if you're out there right now hiking on the Appalachian Trail, I have no idea how you're listening to this. I can't imagine that there's wireless out there on the trail, but I wish you luck in summiting Mount Katahdin. And may the gods of the trail be with you, my friend. Thank you for the email. Now, everyone, please, welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, a true adventurer. This is one of those humans on Earth who has managed to untether themselves from the things that get most of us stuck in that gummy, sticky rat trap of modern life. He's a world traveler. He's been all over the planet, including Antarctica. If you want to see him live, you can go watch his amazing comedy show that he puts on with DJ Doug Pound called Two Wet Crew. You can also see some of the brilliant YouTube videos he's made with Doug Pound. I'll have those up on the comments section of this podcast. And now he's here with us today to share with us stories of adventure and contact with the supernatural that happened in Antarctica. Everybody, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, the intrepid Mikey Campman. It's the Duncan Trussell family. Why am I? This is hard for me. Mikey, welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Duncan.
You are the only person I know on the planet that has been to Antarctica, I think.
Okay.
Why'd you go there?
Why did I go there? It was a long time dream. And I've always kind of lived a little bit like that, where I come up with these visions, these dreams, and then try to find a way to make them happen. Eventually, I had a friend who went and worked down there. Once he went, in my mind, I was like, okay, it's possible now. You know, once I knew someone. Previous to that, I'd kind of seen just like Werner Herzog documentary, read a little bit about Shackleton, who's one of the most badass people in history.
Can you talk about Shackleton a little bit?
Shackleton is one of the true heroes of the like early explorative days of in Antarctic history. He led a few missions. He went to Antarctica multiple times. Most of them failed, including the most famous one where he went in an attempt to traverse Antarctica. It was in 1908, and they got stuck on the ice for 2 years, and they never made it to Antarctica. It was like a crew of 64 people. The ice came around, and froze the boat in the water, and they got stuck there 2 years.
So what did they do for 2 years?
I mean, past the time. Yeah. I don't know. Like
2 years.
2 years.
Let's really think
Christmases. Yeah. I mean, they celebrated Christmas dinners down there.
But what were they eating?
They were hunting for seal. They did have their their supplies, their rations, but eventually those started to run out. Also, the ice was slowly crushing the ship to the point where eventually then they realized we have to abandon the ship and just take the rowboats and now sort of try to field some miraculous escape. And they were able to do it. 64 crew members and not a single one died.
Well, how did they escape?
They slowly made their way across the ice, at times having to get in the boats and sort of sail and then drag them and then sail, drag them. And then eventually they knew with their maps that there was an island of South Georgia. And they thought, if we can get to that island, we have a chance, because there's on the opposite side of this island, there's a little outpost. And so they didn't know. It was kind of like blind sailing. And I think Worley, I think was the name of the captain, who the navigator. And this guy just, I mean, he just knocked it out the park, basically. You know what I mean? In terms of navigation. And sailed them through horrible storms. I mean, that part of the world gets, the waters are frightening. The water's so ice cold. They're freezing to death, basically. They have no food, water. You can't drink.
Isn't that water so cold that if you fall in, you're dead?
Yeah, well, you're like, within 10 minutes, you're like, yeah, hypothermic. But yeah, no drinking water. They finally
made it. What were they drinking?
Nothing. They had some melted ice that they had, but that ran out. And so the first thing, like the image that, because there's all these diaries that were kept. And the first thing they did when they landed on the island was there was a waterfall, and they all just went and ran up to it, and just like it was just trickling down, and they just put their lips to the rock.
Wow.
And just the taste of water. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
What's going through your mind month three?
Yeah.
Into being trapped in Antarctica. You've got your wife. A lot of those guys had girlfriends.
But they knew what they were doing. They knew they were going into a expedition where there was likelihood of death or not returning. They knew that their technology didn't really suit them for that place. It was, you know, the clothing they had was fairly ridiculous. Barely waterproof or anything like this.
How much did they know about Antarctica?
No one had stepped foot on Antarctica until 1904 or 1904, 1902. But no one had even seen it until like 1890 something.
So they just know there's big mass of ice up there.
Yeah. But it's unknown. I mean, there's so much of it that was this unknown territory. And most of it was being motivated by this sort of arbitrary goal of reaching the South Pole, which is, the axis of the Earth. So I guess it's got significance in that respect. But other than that, it's just a place.
Are you familiar with hollow earth theory at all?
No.
See, this is kind of interesting, and it's one of my favorite conspiracy theories. Obviously, I don't believe in it, but I don't think you need to believe in a conspiracy theory to really enjoy it. But the concept is that, so at the poles, there is a portal or like an entryway into the inner depths of the Earth where there's actually another Earth underneath us, and it's tropical down there. It's somehow heated by this it's heated by some kind of luminous, I don't know what. There's theories about how it's heated,
right?
But there's all these interesting stories about people who get up that way and see some weird shit.
Yeah.
You hear about people seeing weird stuff up there. There's a story of a German submarine commander who took his submarine into some kind of subterranean cavern and came out of the water into a cave where there were mammoths, like weird stuff like that. Like all these like prehistoric creatures sort of fled into the interior of the Earth. So Antarctica and that part of the world is a fascinating place, even if it isn't an entryway into a place where there's still mammals, because that used to be tropical, right?
Yeah, once upon a time. And there's landmass actually beneath the ice. There's 9,300 feet of ice at the South Pole. Can I actually also tell you what is physically beneath the South Pole?
Please.
My last night, because I was working at the South Pole station, and I stared at the South Pole every day, and you know, it was phenomenal. It's a flat, nothing place. But on the last night, we go out, someone led this mission, go out to, there's a metal marker that's actually marks the South Pole, and it moves every year because the ice is sliding. But we go out to it, and he pulls it up out of the ground, and he had stashed a joint there. So there's
why that? Like that's so he that joint was charged with the energy of the entire planet.
Yeah,
that's a that's got to be a some kind of energy conduit, right?
Yeah,
that's got to be some kind of. Was it? Well, tell me what it was like to smoke a joint that had been seeded by the energies of the pole.
it was exciting. I mean, it was exciting. It was an. I would go out there on a regular basis, and because I was there, as the breakfast cook at the South Pole Station. I was making breakfast for 250 people every day by myself, as part of a larger kitchen.
That sounds incredibly stressful.
Yeah, and I'm not a chef, so it was all.
How did you get the job?
I said I had cooked in. Yeah, I had. I mean, I had done like a little bit of cooking, you know.
So
one
I
summer.
Guess based on what you're saying, there's not a lot of people in line to cook breakfast in Antarctica.
I got lucky. I couldn't believe how easy it was to for me personally. After years of thinking about going there to try to get myself to Antarctica, and the best way was to work for the United States Antarctic Program, a government job. I have even awarded a medal from Congress and everything. It's kind of cool in that respect. I actually, you know, feel good about that.
How do you? That is really cool, man. Yeah. Whoever, I don't know anyone. Now you're the only person I know who has a medal from Congress. Now, what is the process in applying for this job? Like, tell me from the very beginning, something clicks inside of you. You're ready to make this leap to go to Antarctica.
Yeah.
What are the steps?
Okay, you do have to physically qualify, which I thought was going to be, you know, a pretty good tell of like, okay, I'm fit, I'm in good shape. I've got my go to the dentist, make sure you don't have any cavities, because think about the headache if you have any of that stuff go wrong down there. They have to fly you out. There are medical staff on hand, but not for, they're trying to avoid everything. So anyway, I kind of thought showing up in Antarctica, I was like going to be part of this, you know, fairly fit crew of people. And it's amazing how not true that was in terms of, you know, some people, not very in shape, put it that way.
So, what you mean, just there's obese people up there?
Yeah, Antarctica is about 80% obese.
Really?
No, I'm joking. It's no, but there were some big boys and girls.
It's dangerous to be a big boy.
Yeah,
up there.
I know. But there's also some big boy jobs that down there that, you know.
Like what?
Well, most of it is just is maintaining this insane. Why there? It's inhospitable. It's a station in the middle of somewhere that no one should be.
What are they studying?
Specifically at the South Pole, they're studying the. They're using radio telescopes to map the universe using light that's like. Left over from the Big Bang. It's about light that's 400,000 years old after the Big Bang. So it's been traveling through the universe for about 13 billion years.
Wow.
I mean, if you believe in science and stuff
like that. I do indeed. Yeah. Now, so that is crazy to think. So there's some crazy, tell us, what do they look like? What are the gauges?
They look like a sort of giant satellite.
Yeah.
And they're not visual. They're not visual light telescopes. So you're not zooming in on a star and seeing this beautiful
it's
nebula.
Just electromagnetism.
Exactly.
Right?
It's just microwaves. Think about microwaves.
Microwaves. That's it. Yeah.
And that's what light is, right? So it's just like the most sensitive camera in the world that's detecting the tiniest, faintest microwaves left over from the Big Bang that are like traveling through the universe. And as that light would bend around galaxies and stuff, they can detect that. So they can create a map of the universe. And even I was like, I would go to the telescope after work and try to get this explained, and still doesn't quite make sense. But they could create this sort of map, and the map looks like green dots, clusters, right. Almost like static. But what those clusters are galaxies and huge. I mean, just the scale is huge. But that's only also looking at like 10% of the sky. The universe, man. It's insane.
It's insane, and it's insane that there are these kind of cosmological wizards who have become so interested in what the universe is that they've created an entire, essentially a temple to science in one of the most inhospitable parts of the world so that they could study the first, I guess, breath of first breath of creation. They're up there studying the very first exhalation of matter.
Right. And trying to find if there was any sort of pattern or any sort of structure behind how all this was formed. You know, and on a personal level, a lot of these guys were the same age. And that was the part that for me was, you know, I mean, I dealt with that in my own ways. Go back to my room and cry. And because I'm cooking the breakfast and they had committed their lives to this science and this pursuit of...
Oh, you felt that there was some kind of hierarchy there.
No, not even a hierarchy, but just I was inspired by them and felt like, wow, you know, I've been trying to chase these different little physical pleasures in my life and trying to, you know, have fun, go to shows and whatever, go to the beach. Meanwhile, these guys are just had probably locked themselves up in a classroom or study hall for 15, 20 years. And now it was paying off because they were part of this sort of international science project to map the light from the Big Bang and try to determine how the universe was formed. I mean, that's fascinating.
It's fascinating. Yeah, it really is. But I don't think you should be so hard on yourself.
No.
I think people are, you know, man, like that thing where you look at these brilliant scientists studying microwaves in the South Pole.
Yeah.
And then you look at your own personal life.
Yeah.
Of what you seem to consider to be hedonism to some degree. Self-gratification. And you think, oh, man, what have I done?
Yeah.
All this time I could have been locked up in a classroom.
Yeah.
Learning how to peer into the heart of the universe, into the lifeless, empty, dead, inexplicable part of the universe. But really, if you think about it, if you are sending people to a planet to explore the experience of existence... Right. And they were all getting different assignments.
True.
I have a feeling the people whose job it was to sit in the coldest fucking place on Earth staring at microwave signals, if that's their mission, they're going to be jealous of the guys who got sent to the same dimension to experience orgasm,
true,
great beers,
yeah,
incredibly good times.
Yeah.
Isn't it weird, though, how there's this, like, hierarchy of experience or, like, there's certain experiences which are considered mundane, pedestrian and somehow unimportant, which is generally the experience of like getting high, going to a bar, playing video games, having sex, enjoying walks, going to barbecues. Somehow that is less of an exploration than exploring the deep inner recesses of the universe. But if you consider the oddity of existence at all, it seems like it's all a worthy exploration.
I agree. I mean, ultimately, ultimately, it's like, this is the way I feel. We have been given this window into this to be able to be alive, okay, regardless of what it is, how real it is or whatever. We're here, and we have the ability to observe and we have the ability to have curiosity. And so I guess no matter what direction you explore that in, whether it's to the far reaches of our limitless universe,
yes,
or into your interior, the far reaches of the mind and whatever, it doesn't matter. There's no wrong way to be alive.
Yeah.
As long as you are, this is what I personally think, as long as you're actively exploring and staying curious, my friends.
Right. Yeah.
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 I don't know. That's kind of what's marked my own life and led a lot of the decisions that I've made in my experience to try to take a sip from every glass or whatever. I don't know. I mean, there's certain things I'm like, okay, I'm not going to do that. But at the same time, I don't know. That's what I think. So ultimately, I guess, yeah, I don't actually feel that sorry for myself for being the breakfast cook or whatever like that. But
Yeah. Because without the goddamn breakfast cook,
yeah,
those nerds aren't going to be able to survive long enough to stare at their stupid microwave.
Yeah.
Man, by the way, I'm obviously joking about that. I consider those people to be kind of to me, those are the magicians or those are the wizards and what they're working with science, which to me, it might as well be magic because I don't understand it at all. And I'm not drawn into the deeper understandings of things like that. I just trust that those people, when they articulate what they're picking up, that it's real. I just think, and it does seem so fantastic, and that to me, it's so many people, for whatever reason, feel like science and God can't really get along.
Mm-hmm.
That the conceptualization of a higher intelligence that breathed all of this creation out, if it can be made to apply to science, but that application is always wrong. And that application is plugging in a primitive, archaic paradigm into a brand new paradigm. And the two can't go together. But I just can't disagree with that more. I think that if God represents if you look at the old descriptions of God, there are always things like the highest of the high, the supreme dream.
Yeah.
In the Hare Krishnas call it Bhagavan, I believe, which means the greatest of all things. So the most attractive, the most intelligent, the most beautiful, the most perfect, and everything is an emanation from that thing that they call the Godhead. And so those scientists, they're peering into the Godhead. They're peering into this inexplicable energy burst that contained within it all information, all data. They're recording that initial exhalation of all data into time. And how is that not God?
Yeah.
Isn't that God too? Why can't you worship data? Why can't I worship the sum total of all data?
People do. People already are. Yeah. I was inspired by their work. And I was there in the summer. Okay, here's the other thing. I was in there in the summer. It's population, like, is it 250 while I was there, 4 months. It's light the entire time.
Weird.
So you don't see the nighttime. The sun just does spirals in the sky.
Whoa.
I would start my day at 2:30 in the morning, walk out of my little hut, and just get full blasted sunshine.
Every day is like you are leaving a rave.
Yeah. And there were good parties down there too.
Really?
Yeah, for sure. People are cutting loose down, especially the scientists. It's like this is their chance to kind of be in the field and enjoy the kind of the fruits of the
what kind
project.
Of intoxicants are they taking?
A lot of alcohol,
right?
A lot of alcohol, and that's because a lot of the alcohol it's government subsidized, so it's not. It used to be $10 for a bottle of any booze, and then slowly the year I was there it was $30. But anyway, big parties on the weekend, dance parties, scientists cutting it loose, dancing into the late hours, people passing out around the station.
And a lot of people are humping.
Yes, free condoms in every bathroom at the South Pole, in Antarctica, basically, any U.S. base, because they know what's going on. It's a small, isolated population. People are fucking. People are fucking.
And how do you deal with that when such a small population? Like, aren't people jealous of each other? How do you?
Yeah. Oh, there's like horror stories of relationships gone to shit. Like full couple swaps in the course of a winter. You know where?
Wow.
You know, because the winter is specifically at the South Pole. The winter is 8 months. 6 of those months are in complete darkness. So it's the opposite of the summer. And during that 6 months, things go a little squirrely. You know. So there's stories of
things go a little squirrely.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
In the 6 months of darkness.
Yeah.
It sounds like the beginning of like what you just said. It feels like it should be followed by a story involving vampires, like ice vampires.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's where they talk about things like that. And
they talk about things like that.
They talk about things
like
that.
Who talks about things like that?
My first day on the ice, they call it, so Antarctica, when you're there, it's called the ice. And my first day on the ice, my boss and his assistant, without being solicited, they mentioned the Greys.
What'd they say about the Greys? They said, don't fuck the Greys. You can make love to anyone on the base, but the Greys, they're very jealous. They're going to get weird on you. Don't fuck the Greys.
Yeah, definitely don't do that. No, they said you won't see them much in the summer because they mostly come out in the winter. And both of them had done winters. I had one small experience with sort of an unknown element, and that was there was a couple there from... They said they were from Colorado, and I mean, this is absolutely true from my perspective of experience. They were working in the kitchen. I love them. They were great, good people. But they said they were from Colorado, but they had these accents that were bullshit. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, that's not a Colorado accent,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
If anything, it sounded like from Spain or, I don't know, something was
off.
And... they were a couple, you know, they'd 3 years they'd waited to come down to Antarctica. Antithesis of my experience where I applied and suddenly a week later I had the job.
Wow.
So they had waited 3 years and they were working as dishwashers. Who waits 3 years to become a dishwasher? Okay. Whatever. That's another point.
Yeah.
One day they're in the dish pit and I'm taking in some dishes from breakfast, whatever. And I walk in on them having a conversation. And it was, I'm not joking, they were speaking in a language that was not English, it was not Spanish, and I just didn't recognize it. It sounded digital, truly.
Can you imitate it a little bit? Can you try to do it?
Just
give it a shot.
I swear.
So they're doing clicks.
Yeah, there was like little clicks and just, like I said, digital sounds, okay? And the way I walked in is the female counterpart, she had her back to me. She couldn't see me. She was the one talking. Her husband was kind of at an angle towards me, facing me. So he eventually saw me out of the corner of his eye.
Yeah.
And she's still talking in this language. And she eventually he looks at me, or he sees me, and he looks at her and just says, "Stop."
What?
Yeah.
He said, "Stop."
Stop.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
What do you think that was?
I have no clue. No clue.
Do you connect it with the gray thing? Do you think they're...
The gray thing was mostly fun. You know, it was fun to like point around. I would sit there with one of my coworkers, and we'd point out, who do you think's a gray, you know?
So the concept is that some of the people working in that station could have been aliens,
or they're
government workers,
exactly,
and
that's for some other reason.
And that's some kind of spy language that they're speaking.
Could be.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was like, I kind of would keep my eye on what they would do with their free time. I was always curious what they were doing with their free time around the station. you know, what, because there's parts of the station that you can explore, you know, and each person kind of carves out the world that they want to inhabit while they're at the station.
Yes.
So for me, it was a lot of walking outside, taking in the actual Antarctic landscape, going to check out the science. With them, I don't know. They kind of stuck to themselves a little bit, kind of fairly quiet, but they were great. Like I said, they were great. And I did start like a little rumor that I had heard all this, and that I had a thought that maybe they were aliens or something like this, you know?
Did you get any blowback from that?
I did eventually. Like the last week, you know, last week there at the station, end of summer, you know, it's like any place where it's at the end of the season, things, you know, a couple big parties, people open up about everything. And she goes, "You think I'm an alien?" And I was like, "Hey, I don't know.
Click.
I just don't know."
Did you ask what was the clicks?
Yeah. I heard you, you know, remember that day in the dish pit? She was like, "Yeah." And I was like, "Well, I don't know.
What are the clicks?"
Yeah.
Did you ask her what the clicks were?
No.
Why?
Oh, I don't know. Because you know what ended up happening instead? We were all drinking, and in some symbolic gesture, whether this, like, this obviously doesn't do anything, but it's a cool story. We expressed how much we really just ultimately liked each other and working with each other, and her and her husband and me, we all leaned in and tri-kissed.
Wow.
Yeah. So I always, in my mind, I always pretend that I made out with
a
couple aliens.
You made out. You had the kinkiest makeout session.
God, I would have loved to take that further.
That's the oddest makeout session. Now, that is the strangest makeout session, perhaps, I would guess, that day on planet Earth.
Yeah.
If there was a way, a computer where you could scan and say, bring up the top three strangest makeout sessions that happened today in this 24-hour period, yours would be number one.
Man, it feels like a privilege to be in that group.
A human made out with a male and female alien in a base in the North Pole.
Yeah.
And found in some kind of way in that moment, perhaps, you...
Unity. Connection.
To the whole universe.
Yeah, of course.
In that moment, it was, you don't even know. Perhaps at that moment, everything was teetering in the balance. You could have created an alliance with some race that...
Yeah.
Listen, man, you know, that's the funny thing about Hollow Earth theory,
mm-hmm.
because you, and not clearly the people up there know about this, you do know that a lot of people say the UFOs and the grays don't come from outer space, but they come from within the interior of the
Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is the mythology is there's all these stories and of these subterranean beings that, you know, dwarfs, creatures that live under the earth. They're in all kinds of mythologies. And many people say that there is a race of beings that live within the core of the earth, and that it's actually kind of strange that we as humans have decided to live on the outside of the spaceship.
Right.
And that the fact that we have decided to make camp on the outside of the spaceship is not something that happens in other planets. So, because other advanced species, after infinite catastrophes involving meteor impacts...
Okay.
Realize that to truly build a lasting civilization,
right.
you can't do it on the surface of any planet because those planets are always being smashed to pieces by meteorites.
Wow.
So you got to go inside.
Yeah.
So Mars, Pluto, Venus, all these planets are just the exterior shells of these
spaceships.
Yeah,
and they're just watching us thinking, fucking idiots.
Yeah, they're watching us. Yeah, they're like, or maybe they're like, maybe they'll figure it out.
Or they're just, yeah.
Of course, again, man.
I'm jealous. Earth is amazing.
Earth is incredible. We have the beach.
Yeah, we have the beach. We have the mountains. We have so many varied landscapes. Even here in the United States, the more I travel, the more I realize that we essentially have, from a landscape perspective, we have everything you would ever want from other parts of the world.
Oh, you mean the United States?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nuts what we have. It's so crazy that we have that.
I was in the Olympic Peninsula last weekend up in Washington State. It's a rainforest that centers around Mount Olympus, but it's big. So it's a peninsula, so there's coastline all along the exterior. It's a beautiful part of the country. It's pristine. It's fairly empty. You know, there's not many people living up there. It's nice to know that these places still exist. And we went and we're in a small little fishing village in Lepush. And then there's beach camping. You hike in 3/4 mile. And that night we were camping and it was a new moon. So there's no moon, but also it's the Pacific Northwest, the Olympic Peninsula. It was like completely fogged over. So you couldn't see a single cloud. You couldn't see a single star, and you couldn't see the moon. So there was no light. We had a little beach fire going. But we look out at the ocean, and we can see these waves just perfectly. Like, it made no sense to us because there was no light. So we get up, we walk closer to the beach, and we realize it was phosphorescent waves. It was bioluminescence in the water.
Wow.
And every time it was churned up, it would essentially create that energy that would create the bioluminescence to light up. So we watched these waves just crash and create these little like green lines of light down the whole coastline.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, that is so you are a traveler. You don't stick. You're just like, you've made this decision.
Right.
You're not going to get caught up in any kind of single pattern. You're always doing things like that while I'm inside.
Right.
With the hum of the air conditioner. And The Binding of Isaac, the video game I'm currently addicted to, iTunes, Netflix, Game of Thrones.
Float tank. Which is a portal to anywhere that you want to go.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't, there's no, as far as I'm aware, bioluminescent waves that I can watch. I'm not making out with aliens in there yet. but you're someone who's done this thing where you've decided to plunge into the energy of life and you're an adventurer.
When I was 16 years old, I'd been studying Chinese in high school, so someone before me at the school went to China for a year, and as part of it's not an exchange program, it's just you go, it's a little school year abroad, and I get that opened my eyes, and I went to China at 16. I only did a semester because I didn't want to go too far when I was young. So 6 months in Beijing, and first time I'd been exposed to other culture and everything. And in that 6 months, I learned more about not only the world, but myself and everything. Meanwhile, while just taking in incredible new array of sights and sounds and flavors, whatever. And made great friendships for that time.
You're always making friends,
anyway,
but not keeping...
I realized immediately that education, my true education, was going to be defined through travel. And and so then it became sort of this hunger to go explore as many places, because the more I started to travel, the more I realized there is no one right way to live. You know what I mean? It's what we have, our greatest characteristic as a species is our diversity, truly.
Right.
In the way that, and I kind of started studying social anthropology at college as well, and that kind of reinforced that. Because there, you start learning about ethnographic societies that experience the world with smell as their primary sense, as opposed to sight.
Oh, cool.
Or, all these.
That's crazy.
There was a group of people in South America that believe that humans, our real body form is a snake, and we take we put on like a body to experience this world. But as our spiritual form, it's like it's like almost like you zipper down the front of your face and peel out of the skin, and you're a snake.
I want to ask you your opinion on this. I'm reading right now this. Great. I'm really enjoying this book by Sam Harris called Waking Up.
Okay.
Sam Harris is, I haven't finished the book yet, so if I say things that he says later on, I'm sorry for those of you who are big Sam Harris fans, and I know a lot of you are. He talks about the idea that certain religions, mm-hmm. most religions, Christianity, Islam, he talks about theosophy, Madame Blavatsky, or he talks about a lot of these very esoteric metaphysical systems as though they are kind of impediments to a person's discovery of truth. So a person who believes that he has a snake inside of him.
Right.
And I'm sorry, I don't mean to speak for Sam Harris. I don't know what he would say about that person necessarily, but I think maybe you could, it would be safe to say that Dawkins, someone like Richard Dawkins would say, that's a bunch of superstitious bullshit.
Sure.
There is no snake inside of you, my friend.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a person with bones and cells and a spine. And though it's quaint and cute that you believe there's a snake inside of you, the reality of the situation is that belief in the long run is impeding you from achieving the kind of health, perhaps longevity the ability or technology that can only be obtained from coming into direct contact
right.
with quantifiable truth.
Sure.
So when you say diversity is the most important thing, the most beautiful thing.
Yeah.
How would you respond to the concept that this diversity is, much of this diversity is made up of superstitious thought patterns that are completely unverifiable and have no basis in reality?
Well, whose reality first? Okay, reality is this is what you make of it, in a way. Or you choose truth. Is you're making those choices all the time to live in what the world you want to live in. But from my perspective, when I think about that and those two varying different points of view, I think, first of all, how lucky I am to be able to sit here and know that both exist and make my own conscious decision about which one I think is valid or choose in my life when right. I want those points to be valid. But outside of that, it makes me happy to know that there were people who were existing in their own isolated community where that's how they found meaning. It doesn't matter. It like, what are we chasing? Like, what does Richard Dawkins want? Like, what's his end game goal?
Well, I don't know what he wants, but I can guess what he doesn't want.
Okay.
And what he doesn't want is the people who believe that there are snakes inside of them, or the people who believe that their God is telling them that homosexuality is evil.
Sure.
Or the people who are saying from time to time, you need to put on dynamite and walk into cafes for the Lord.
Yeah.
I know that Dawkins, and I'm pretty sure Harris, don't want those people to have any kind of political power, because if they do, they fuck shit up.
Yeah.
And if you look at the Age of Faith, you look at the brakes that were put on human evolution by the Catholic Church, the Christian community, they went from being these kind of quaint, interesting sweeties. And I don't mean the Christian community, the fundamentalists, because the Christian community is its own diverse, wild beast. But the fundamentalists went from being what they currently are, or they went from being... Rather, they went from being essentially like, if there is a Satan, the hand of Lucifer on earth, they became the wall that got in the way of some of the great thinkers. They killed a lot of the greatest thinkers. They, in the same way ISIS is demolishing ancient temples in Syria, in the same way that ISIS is throwing gay people off of roofs. And I know they're a very small cluster of people that have probably been inflated in danger by the media, mm-hmm. but still they exist. That's what it used to be like everywhere, which was that you would get burned at the stake, tortured, executed, and destroyed for your beliefs, because many of these religions, which in small microdoses and thought patterns seem very quaint and cool, and you can really dig your teeth into it and think, man, I can see how I'm a snake. If that expands too much and becomes a dominant paradigm, then the end result is the complete slowdown, if not stopping, of technological progress.
Yeah.
And technological progress holds within it the key for human beings to migrate into space.
I agree.
And populate. Now, by the way, what I did, I have played devil's advocate there because I don't know. Of these two perspectives, it's like the great question is here, as population grows and as access to technology becomes as technology becomes increasingly accessible to larger portions of the human population,
mm-hmm.
then what that means is that it becomes increasingly dangerous for people who believe in things like angry Jehovah God. I don't know about the snake people. I don't even mean to bash them, man. I'm just using them as a point. It becomes increasingly dangerous. What are we going to do when you can 3D print a fucking bioweapons laboratory? What are you going to do when you're able to somehow create some kind of like, when you're able
this is what I think. This is what I think. I think the biggest lesson that we need to teach our future generations is that very simple concept that there is no one way of to do things.
Right.
And I heard a four-year-old child say this the other day. He was playing with a friend, and the friend was trying to build some blocks, and the kid was struggling or something. And so this boy came over, 4 years old. He's like, hey, let me show you one way to do this. And I was like, dude, the future. Okay, there's some hope. There's a chance.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm constantly conflicted with our current state of things going on in the world. I sit and kind of think about this and have an existential crisis all the time because I'm not sure if this is the most exciting time where it's like finally people are starting to be able to recognize the folly in so many of the decisions of our societal structure, especially Western society, for the last 500 years, or you know. There's that view, or just think, fuck, the population's too big. The people who did begin the kind of clutch of power 500 years ago have now gone to a place where they control so much beyond what we even know. It's always mind blowing to think about what we don't know in terms of decisions that are actually being made on a day to day basis to run the world, and think, okay, we're fucked. You know, there's no way. So what are you supposed to do in the meantime? But I don't know. I think all you can do is just focus on, like, in your own world. Like, I hear that the kids say that, you know, or think about people starting to maybe come back to our earth and be like, oh, let's treat it a little bit better or whatever like that, and awareness for that. And I think, okay, just live small and slowly maybe it'll make a difference or something like that.
I think you're right.
But it's so funny because when I think you make a personal decision, your first thing that you mention with a 3D printer is bio warfare. I guess that's a realistic look at the world.
This is the problem. Here's the problem. So the problem is this: the technology is an amplification device. And the way it amplifies things is like any other amplifier.
Uh-huh.
It can amplify the lectures of Ram Dass,
mm-hmm.
or Jack Kornfield or Gandhi, or it can amplify the YouTube comments of Derek 7964, who wants to leave comments in every single video about how the person who posted the video is a faggot and deserves to die. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can now if you look and see, now I think YouTube comments, as much as people decry them, I think they're a fantastic way to understand the problem of technology. Because when you see an angry YouTube comment written by a racist homophobe, maybe a 12-year-old, maybe a 30-year-old, filled with violence and just pure, deep, sizzling anger.
Sure.
Essentially like putting a stethoscope to the wall of hell and hearing the moans of the damned. That's what YouTube comments remind me of. I think if you were in hell, walking through hell, you wouldn't hear people crying for help. You would hear people saying, "You stupid fat shit!
Yeah,
get the fuck away from me, you stupid fat fuck! You fucking shit fuck!" I think that's what you'd hear mostly in hell. Oh. You wouldn't hear, "Oh God, please help me."
Yeah,
you just hear the gnashing and the lashing out of the damned.
Sure.
So when you read YouTube comments,
yeah, we got one. Sorry,
please,
we got one. DJ Doug Pound. And now Jay Wanger as well. We have a show called Two Wet Crew, and we make videos for it.
Great show.
And thank you. On one of the videos, someone just said, "You're not Tim and Eric. Why would you want to be, faggots?"
Right.
And I'm just like, where's that coming from?
Exactly. Well, it's coming from pain.
Yeah, pain.
It's coming from a deep... Because you have to put yourself in the position of a person leaving... the comment. And you also have to analyze. It's really like, so, you know, every time you read a shitty comment, it gives you a tiny pinprick of sadness. It makes you feel a little bad. You do feel bad.
Yeah.
Little bad, maybe a lot bad. It'll get to you. But there's initial, it doesn't feel good.
No.
No matter how advanced you want to be, it still sucks. So that's one little pixel of suffering that person has generated on Earth. Now, if you take the sum total of all shit comments being posted per second on this planet,
yeah,
then you can see that technology is not only creating wonderful euphoric states of distraction, bliss, entertainment, and knowledge, but it's also generating a pretty steady rate of toxic emotional pain. And it's probably, for all the good it's doing, you could say, there's an equivalent, hopefully not equivalent, but potentially equivalent amount of bad that's happening simultaneous.
Right.
And the problem with that is that because of what Kurzweil calls the law of accelerating returns, those two sides are going to amplify. Their energy is going to increase and increase and increase and increase as we move into the future. And so what that means is that idiots are no longer going to just be using YouTube comments as a means to spread their poison into the world, but they're going to adopt, or they're going to use any technology that they can, or anything that you give an angry person, that person will use it to hurt.
Right.
If I give an angry person a pen, the angry person within a certain amount of time is going to write a shitty note to somebody about how they suck.
Yeah.
If I give an angry person a gun, depending on how angry they are, there is a very high probability that angry person is going to use that tool to kill a person. If I give an angry person access to the entire mind of the planet where they could say anything they want to all of humanity to be recorded eternally in the digital transcript that's being created thanks to the growth of technology, they will use that to imprint not some beautiful thing, but to permanently imprint a tiny poisonous thorn, which will last as long as there is a planet or as long as there's hard drives.
These curses and thorns. I've heard you talk about the curses before and the power of how awful. Yeah.
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 So I don't know why I'm getting so, I don't mean to get so dire here.
No.
The point I'm getting at is the next thing down the line and the next thing down the line and the next thing down the line, it's going to be increasingly powerful.
Sure.
And so when these shitheads get a hold of it, they're going to use it to wreak havoc,
but
and that's
stupidity is equally as big of an amplifier, right?
Yes.
So where does that come from? That comes from pain, not only pain, but it also comes from sort of a fairly, regardless of whether it's temporary or permanent, a very narrow view at life.
Yes.
And maybe that's from the pain. Pain has a way of sort of bringing everything down into just this little one tunnel of vision, and so it's all you want to feel, and you fucking are blind to all this incredible other positive energy that's around you.
Yes.
So, I personally, this is my how I deal with that, and how I deal with people who are doing these insane things around the world, hurt, killing people, creating making people feel bad for just trying to express themselves in whatever way they feel happy, whatever. Happiness is whatever. It's bullshit in some respects, but...
You think so?
It's a shallow pursuit, happiness.
Happiness?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it ignores pain.
Can you...
You have to accept pain as part of your daily process.
I think that sometimes if you really analyze pain...
Yeah.
You realize that it's actually making you happy, too.
Yeah. Absolutely. I've been going through that quite a bit lately.
How so?
That I find myself... Sometimes I like being addicted to painful scenarios because then it gives me something to brood about or to think about. And then when something in that situation changes slightly better, then it creates this euphoric sense of, and it's a delusional sense that things are going to be great. Or it's
right.
going to work out.
Like so, the waveform. You're sort of like getting off on the waveform.
Of course, yeah. That's the story of most of our culture is about riding that wave between, happiness and pain, and we like watching people fall and rise and come up over again because it reminds us of parts of our own day-to-day life.
Right.
But ultimately, some people do feel more pain than not. But you have to understand that that's a voice. That's one voice. Our population is 7,000 people. And then let's think about the populations of people who exist outside of ourselves, whether it be other animals or plants on this planet or...
Right.
People outside of Earth, or life outside
sure.
of Earth. Everyone in that universe is experiencing some sort of level of pain, from anywhere from pain to ecstatic ecstasy.
Yes.
Okay? And so at some point in your life, you're going to feel every one of the emotions that's in that range. And so when I see people just crying out in such, terrible agony or suffering, and it just reminds me that, hey, that's okay, been there, and I have a choice to either inhabit that space or try to put more positive energy into the world. That's how I personally go about my life, because I find that I enjoy myself more, I enjoy the people around me more, I enjoy this planet more when I am putting positive energy into the world. It's that simple.
It's beautiful.
I mean, it's that simple, ultimately, right?
It's that simple.
Yeah. And it's such a waste of time.
Well, yeah, it is. Well, I'm sorry, you guys. I have to quote that. I have to always say Ram Dass says, because he does say, and I don't want to seem like I'm lifting his brilliant idea, which is that we exist on a lot of different levels at once.
Yeah.
I just read this great essay by him, actually, where he's talking about when you're playing Monopoly, on one level, your friends play Monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, let's hang out and play Monopoly. It'll be a blast.
Mm-hmm.
But on another level, simultaneous to being friends, you're vicious enemies trying to fuck each other over in the most extreme way.
Of course.
And these two things are happening at once.
Yes.
And if you remove the vicious enemies, or if you move the competitive aspect of Monopoly, and it's not just happy competitive, it's generally a kind of mean competitive capitalist. That's part of the fun of the game, right?
Yeah.
So if you remove that, then it's not that fun to play. You almost need both of those levels functioning at the same time for it to be fun.
Yeah.
I don't want to have a friendly game of Monopoly. I'm sorry. I'm not gonna. That's the most boring thing you could do. I want a cutthroat, vicious, mean-spirited, unhappy, poisonous game of Monopoly that after the game, you kind of have to like...
You don't talk.
Me and my brother and my dad, when we played Monopoly, we actually had something called the Dollar of Shame. And whoever won could say, write whatever statement they wanted on the dollar bill, and whoever lost had to sign underneath the statement.
Oh, no way.
So the bill is filled with things like my dad saying, like, I am the greatest father that has ever lived. stuff like that. And we have to sign it. But that's part of the fun. So when we're, on this planet, you have you get to decide which of these games you want to play.
Right.
Do you want to play the game of being the depressed, angry, unhappy, bitter, jaded victim? Or do you want to play the game of being an expansion of the most beautiful, perfect, incredible, ever-amplifying, harmonized energy that has ever existed, because it's all that does exist? Do you want to let that be the wind in your sails, or will the wind in your sails be a kind of zombie-like, dull movement in the direction of fleeting temporary pleasure generated from causing your fellow human beings pain?
Right. It's a no-brainer for me. It's been a no-brainer for a long time. I don't know why. I feel like I had a lot of people growing up who were like, wow, you know that already? What? And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? Like, how did you not figure that out?
Well,
like,
some people are fall asleep. You know, when I think about when I've been a true cunt in the world, in the times that I find myself being a cunt, when mindfulness comes back and I'm able to look at what I've done or how I acted, it appears that I've gone to sleep. It appears that I've gone into a very thick, congealed state where I'm rushing from meaningless point to meaningless point. You know, a lot of those suffering, a lot of people in hell are always in a hurry to get to the worst part of hell.
Yeah.
It's like people in hell, I guarantee there would be long lines of angry people waiting to try to get to certain fire pits that are worse than the ones they were in.
That sounds like a perfect description of Los Angeles as well.
You know?
Yeah.
But the thing that I've been playing around with lately it all comes from that incredible, and I'm going to mispronounce it again. I got corrected by a lot of people last time I said this, but there's this thing called the Emerald Tablet of I'm going to look it up because I'm not going to mispronounce it this time. Thanks for correcting me, you guys. There's this thing called the Emerald Tablet of Trimestigis. I was saying Trimestigeris. The Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trimestigis, which is this alchemical text that is very simple. I'll just read a little bit of it to you. It's very simple. It's just a few lines. Let's see if I can find it. Really short. But the first part of it is true without error, certain and most true, that which is above is as that which is below, and that which is below is as that which is above, to perform the miracles of the one thing. I'll read the whole thing. Why don't we read the whole fucking thing? Because I talk about it all the time. And as all things were from one, by the mediation of one, so from this one thing came all things by adaptation. Its father is the sun, its mother is the moon, the wind carried it in its belly, the nurse thereof is the earth. It is the father of all perfection and the consummation of the whole world. Its power is integral if it be turned to earth. Thou shalt separate the earth from the fire, the subtle from the coarse, gently and with much ingenuity. It ascends from earth to heaven and descends again to earth and receives the power of the superiors and the inferiors. Thus thou hast the glory of the whole world. Therefore, let all obscurity flee before thee. This is the strong fortitude of all fortitude, overcoming every subtle and penetrating every solid thing. Thus the world was created. Hence are all wonderful adaptations of which this is the manner. Therefore am I called Hermes, the thrice great, having the three parts of the philosophy of the whole world. That is finished which I have to say concerning the operation of the sun. That last part's kind of like he's like a rapper. Like, what's thrice great? He like had to like, he gave himself props at the end real quick. He says all these brilliant things at the end. He's like, I'm not great once, motherfucker. I'm great three times, whatever that means. But I've been thinking a lot about the, that which is as above, so below. And I've been thinking about how I, and most people I know, want love. We want to be loved.
Oh my God, yeah.
We want to be loved so bad. And when we're being loved, we feel complete. When love is happening, we feel so good and so complete, and like we're getting this incredible sustenance, this food. We're like Shackleton's men. When love comes, lapping at the waterfall and drinking it up as though we've been out in the ice forever.
Yeah.
So if you consider as above, so below, and imagine that that is within us, and then just as a thought experiment, imagine that that is a desire not just in humans, but in all things. That the entire world, the entire universe, and we're part of the fabric of the universe, is longing for this love. And then you start, instead of trying to pull that love to you,
right,
start giving it not just to the people around you, but to every single moment, as though all things were some super entity,
yeah,
and you had been called here just to love it, then that shifts you from one frequency to another instantaneously. And all of a sudden you look around and you think about the words of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, who said, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It's here right now.
Of course.
Around you all the time. This is, you are truly in heaven. The only thing keeping you from it is the fact that you keep trying to suck love from the world instead of breathing love out.
Well, when I've been truly in love in my personal life, I find that what I enjoy about it most is it actually makes me be expressive towards other people in the world around me in a loveful way. Like when you see someone who's truly in love, they walk into a room and they are beyond happy. I mean, they are there. They are just like an open, you know, book or cup or whatever, ready to just sort of drink in their environment.
Window.
Yeah.
Open window.
Yeah.
And if you look into it, you can see heaven.
Yeah.
And that creates other openings and other windows.
Yeah.
And then before you know it, there's no more windows. It's just all heaven. And then that's when you start experiencing those crazy synchronicities.
Oh, man. Okay. I think I've told you this story before, but it works perfectly about this, because the opposite of that when you're not in love is, like we said, you're closing your world down and you're seeing this such a narrow view, and you're creating pain. You're eating yourself up from the inside out, right? So I had come back from Africa, Ethiopia. It was the first time I traveled to Africa, and it was a heavy trip. Every time I've been to Africa 3 times, every time I've come back, there's a post-trip sort of depression.
Why?
You just see certain things specifically.
Like what?
People's day-to-day living conditions, their quality of life, the conditions they live in that they didn't have a choice about, that they were born into.
Right.
And they're being held at bay by corrupt people and greedy people, because there's tons of money in Africa. And
right.
There's all, right, whatever. It's
tons of resources. Of mineral resources.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some crazy things going on in Africa all the time. And it just goes fairly ignored. But anyway, every time I've come back, I've been pretty depressed.
Why is it ignored? This is something I wonder about all the time. Why do we ignore that? Why is that part of the world completely... The world turns its back on Africa. No one...
fucking don't know. I honestly... I don't know.
Like Africa and North Korea. Like North Korea, you can kind of understand because... But Africa, yeah, it's like... When like Ebola broke out there and...
Yeah.
People are just like, well, you know, we were not really
passive,
sad about them.
Passive.
We were just like, well, I hope it doesn't make it over here.
Yeah.
I don't care if it liquefies everyone over there. It's just, let's hope that they don't get on our airplanes. It's kind of fucking strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it because they don't have oil? Do you think it's, if Africa had a bunch of oil over there, like if there was a Saudi Arabia level of oil reserves, that we would be helping them more?
Possibly.
Anyway, please.
There's still racism. Let's be honest. A lot of that.
You think it's racism?
There's still a lot of that. Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's a little bit of racism, but I'll tell you, man, racism has never stopped the United States military from helping folks if there's some fucking oil out there.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
You know, like there is this weird coincidence.
Shit.
Isn't that a weird? That's one of the great coincidences to me of our military. Or our war strategy is that it does seem like the most evil people are to be found around oil. Like, you definitely, when we're going in to like rescue and help people. There's always oil nearby.
Yeah.
It's so crazy to imagine if the United States actually, and maybe it was scary if they were driven by some ethics instead of pure financial desire. But if we started sending
people. If that technology was done. If that technology could just be done.
It'd be crazy.
Yeah. It'd be wonderful.
It'd be wonderful. Like if we actually started like using all of our resources, not to suck oil from the earth, but to help people. Just sending out troops to go into other countries and distribute food.
Right.
Why don't we do that? Will someone let me know why we don't do that?
Yeah,
I can't remember.
Write an email, please. Okay, so I'd come back from Africa feeling pretty shit, just depressed. Had a small fling that didn't work out. I mean, it was compound stuff, but I started getting this funk.
A fling with who in Africa?
No. It was a relationship back home.
Okay, gotcha.
But it was these compound things. So relationship, going to shit, coming back from Africa, having seen some pretty hardcore things for the first time, like on that level.
You saw some dead bodies and stuff.
You see, yeah. You see people on the side of the road who are
dead.
Gonna be, well,
dying.
Yeah.
People are just dying.
Yeah.
So you
in certain places, not all, but.
So this is
especially in Addis Ababa, the capital. You see in the cities, you see the most hardcore things.
How are they dying?
They're just poor.
They're starving to death.
Starving to death.
So this is the United States, and it's a pretty easy thing to forget that our version of being down and out here, is a lot of people's version of doing just fucking great.
Absolutely.
And in some parts of the world, you can actually starve to death.
Right.
People don't realize that you can actually starve to death.
Yeah.
Like, right. Like they just are like, yeah, that guy doesn't have food. So we're going to let him die. Yeah. We're not going to give him food.
Right.
So you saw that.
I've
never seen that kind of poverty before. I've been to India, but I don't think I've ever seen anyone starving to death.
Right.
I've seen people very poor in India, but I think they're taken care of to some degree.
Yeah. Poor and sick and, just don't have any, no means.
There's no government programs in Africa. There's no, like,
Africa is so, okay, Africa, of course, is so huge. In Ethiopia, Ethiopia is its own kind of place. I'm not knowledgeable enough to truly speak on it. But, I don't know. I don't know what the deal was going on. I wish I could talk about it. I can't. So I'll just move on. Come home, dealing with all these issues in a funk. First, I think I can just change it with my willpower, tell myself I'm okay. But that's just, I'm not actually, I'm just trying to hide it, mask it. So eventually, having done psychedelic mushrooms in the past, and knowing that their ability to sort of expose things going on inside force you to sort of take a look inward and face yourself in the mirror. I said, I'm going to seek these out as a tool, as a medicine to try to deal with this funk. So I take them by myself, at a friend's house. I'm at his house for a little bit and I leave and I start to, go through my trip and I'm walking in the streets of, Portland, Oregon. And eventually, I'm feeling all these dark thoughts, just extremely dark, and it's working. I mean, it is working in this to uncover all this. And I go to cross a road. It's like a 4-lane road, and I think I'm walking at a pretty reasonable pace. I had checked to make sure cars weren't coming, but obviously my perception of time was off.
Oh.
I didn't get hit, but I found myself. And I don't know how long had passed, but I found myself crying in the middle of the road while cars waited on both sides with their like headlights on me.
Wow.
And it was such a raw moment where I was essentially like with all these lights and people staring at me on stage in a very dangerous way, of course, crying, feeling dark and shitty for myself.
Yeah.
And I immediately started laughing. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Because I was like, what a dumbass move. First of all, what a dumbass move. And second of all, like, how ridiculous. Like I did not... Who leaves their house and just thinks I'm going to cry in the middle of the road today? So I started laughing and then crying and then laughing and then crying. And it was just, like, back and forth. And I'm walking, it's nighttime now, and I'm walking down the road, and there's this little window open to a basement, and from the basement there's some sort of church choir practicing singing. And they're, from their perspective, regardless of whether it's Christianity or whatever, they were singing from a place of this love that they have, yes, for this thing, God or whatever.
Yes.
What my favorite description of God is that it's just love. God is love. It's that whole Salvation Mountain,
yes,
thing. So they're singing, and I hear this music, and I hear that love in their voice for something else, for the world, for God, whatever. And I stopped walking, and I stood there, and I listened, and it was beautiful. As you can imagine, I mean, everything's heightened as well, but it just was so phenomenal. And then the song ended, and I just saw a hand reach to the window and close it.
Wow.
And it was like just a one song glimpse into this world or whatever to have that moment. And I continued to walking, and immediately I knew the moral lesson of this story. And what had been eating me up was that I would rather love someone else than hate myself. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Spending that energy. I had been in, yes, in that 2 months, I had been,
yes,
beating myself up, trying to just, I don't know, like fix it. But and I was creating all that energy, thinking about how painful and shitty my situation is, and how fucked up the world is. And yet I could have been spending that time expressing love to other things.
You went from input to output.
Exactly. Yeah.
Shifted the energy.
Yeah.
And the moment you shift the energy, whatever this stuff is, your universe turns into a different universe.
Absolutely.
There appears to be two universes existing simultaneously.
All the time. And it's not even two. It's
a lot.
It's a lot.
But it seems like if there is a lot with all the variances that can happen, it seems like you could almost divide one group of potential universes in another group with this very simple line between. And one universe is populated by people who are all input, and the other universe has people in it who are output, and the input people are in hell because they're trying to scratch an itch,
mm-hmm,
in the exact wrong way. It's like they're scratching the wrong part of their body. They think that they have an itch on their foot when the itch is on their neck.
Yeah.
Only in this case, the feeling of hunger that they're having or suffering can only be quenched by giving love to other people. And the moment you start giving love out to other people, all this other shit that was going inside of you really evaporates.
Yeah.
But I think it's...
not easy, though. I mean, it's easy to sit here and talk, you know...
I think it's easy.
Yeah. About these kind of lovey-hippie kind of ideas or humanistic ideas about the world, but...
I think it's easier than you think.
Yeah.
I think you got to do a thing where you give more than you than feel. I think really, and it might not work every time.
Right.
But I think that if you identify somebody in your life who needs help,
uh-huh,
and give them more than you think you should.
Right.
And do it right after you finish listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
My guess would be that you will experience, at least in that moment, you will experience the opening of that church window for a second.
Absolutely.
And hear the singing of angels.
Absolutely.
And it happens real quick.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll go away. Maybe the window slams shut again. But all you need is for that fucking window to open a few times.
And once you know it exists, it always will.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
This has been just a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for being on the show, Mikey.
Yeah, of course.
How can people find you?
Well, the main sort of creative thing I'm doing in my life right now is this Two Wet Crew show. We make videos. It's supposed to be comedy, I think.
It is.
Yeah,
hilarious.
It's comedy. And we have a live show at the Satellite in Los Angeles. So we do that. Also, I'm my own person, so I exist out there on the internet as well as here.
Where are you on Twitter?
Mikey Campman.
That's Got it.
Yeah.
I'll have all the links online. Thank you so much for being on the show, man.
Thanks, Duncan.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Please support Squarespace by going to squarespace.com and signing up for a membership. Use offer code Duncan. You'll get 10% off your first order. Also, a giant thanks to Rob Crew for fixing the sound in this podcast. And most importantly, a thank you to you for continuing to listen. I love you guys. We got some great podcasts coming up with Daniele Bellelli, Tom Green. That's coming next month. I hope you'll continue to listen, and I'll see you around. Have a great weekend or week. Bye.
I'm so excited.